This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.
Welcome to a three-part mini-series of Property Patter, focusing on the Building Safety Act. My name is Michael O'Connor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sylvia Yatchak and Melanie Hardingham. Sylvia is in our real estate disputes team here at Charles Russell Speechleys, and Melanie works in our construction, engineering and projects team. The UK real estate and construction industries have been living with the Building Safety Act for almost 2 years now, and the amount of legislation, secondary legislation, developing regulatory reform and case law arising for the BSA is and will be substantial. Even in a three-part mini-series, we don't have enough time to consider all aspects of the BSA. I think if we did, it would end up being an epic trilogy like Lord of the Rings or something out of Star Wars. So instead, for this series, we're going to focus on, first off, reflections of some of the key regulatory changes that have been brought about by the BSA up to date. Episode two, we'll look at the impact of building liability orders and remediation contribution orders on residential developments, and particularly the far-reaching nature of such orders. We'll also consider the impact of the FTT's decision in the triathlon case. Finally, episode three, we will consider other ways in which the regulations and the BSA will have an impact on both the real estate and construction industries going forward. So, turning back to some of the key regulatory changes that have been brought into effect already. Both 1 October 2023 and 6 April 2024 saw dramatic changes to the regulatory landscape for the construction and management of high-risk buildings. Melanie, for you, what were some of the key changes brought in on 1 October 2023?
Thanks, Mike. Well, from a construction perspective, there were a number of regulatory changes that were introduced by the Building Safety Act, one of which was the registration for buildings. So all existing higher risk buildings that are in occupation had to be registered by the 1st of October 2023. Missing that deadline is a criminal offence, which carries a penalty of an unlimited fine or imprisonment, or potentially both. In addition, all new higher-risk buildings must also be registered with the Building Safety Regulator, and they cannot be occupied until it has been registered. And again, failure to register is a criminal offence. We also saw the introduction of the new building control regime for higher-risk buildings. We saw the introduction of a statutory role of the Building Safety Regulator, who would oversee the new higher risk regime. And we also saw the introduction of a new gateway regime for construction of higher risk buildings. And this was to act as a stop-start decision points where approval must be obtained from the Building Safety Regulator at specific points of the construction works. And if you fail to obtain those, you cannot progress with the works. So there's three gateways. Gateway one applied at the planning stage, gateway two applies at the pre-construction phase, and gateway three applies on completion. There was a 6-month transitional period which ends on 6th of April 2024, and assuming all the transitional criteria is met, then the works will not have to comply with gateways two and three.
Picking up on the gateways, I'm in discussions with lots of clients about the gateways and how they will be managed and the stop-start nature of those. Are you also hearing concerns from clients about that, and what are they doing about managing that process on the gateways?
Yeah, absolutely. We're hearing a lot of concerns around delay. There is a time period, a statutory time period, for the Building Safety Regulator to approve, to give its approval at gateway. So gateway two, it's 12 weeks for new buildings or 8 weeks for works to existing buildings. And for gateway three, it's 8 weeks, irrespective of whether it's works to existing or new buildings. So there is some concern that those time periods in itself are going to cause delays. However, that has generally become accepted and understood that this will just have to be built into the programme. Where there's greater concern is around delays from the Building Safety Regulator on those time periods. And this has arisen through concerns that there's potentially not adequately resourced to deal with the sheer volume of applications that they're going to see come through. So there could potentially be a longer delay of 8 to 12 weeks. And we're seeing that concern, particularly at the completion stage, because at Gateway 3, you apply for a completion certificate, which can only be applied following completion of the notifiable works. Now, you cannot occupy a building until it is registered, and you can't register the building until you have that completion certificate. So a delay in the completion certificate is going to cause a delay in occupying the building. And there doesn't seem to be a great deal of information out there as to how to ensure that these timescales are adhered to. So in particular, if the building safety regulator does not respond in those statutory time periods, then the application is deemed rejected unless you submit an appeal. So there's obviously delay concerns there. Now, the appeal process itself is going to cause delays, and there is no prescribed time period as to how long an appeal will be responded to. So there's uncertainty there. What we do know is an appeal can only be submitted at the end of the 8 or 12 week period, at which point there's a 6 week window to submit that appeal. And during that 6 week window, the building safety regulator is prohibited from deciding on the original application. So there is a lot of potential for delay and a lot of uncertainty around that delay. And I think that's where a lot of concern is gaining traction in the industry. And we're also seeing concern from developers as to how they will hold contractors responsible after practical completion during that 8 week window where they're making an application for the completion certificate, if there were any errors in that application which caused that certificate to be rejected or the application to be rejected, then how can they continue to hold them accountable? And vice versa, contractors are concerned about being held responsible beyond practical completion and how that may potentially impact their pipeline of work if they need to remain available to respond to any queries or resubmissions in respect to the application at Gateway 3.
Yes, interesting. I mean, I think that from my perspective, the way that the regulations are set up are intended to have these hard stops. And, you know, I think what it has done is encourage discussions between employers and developers and their supply chains as to how these gateways and hard stops are to be managed. I don't think there's been a clear landing spot reached as between developers and contractors, but it's something that is clearly being discussed and negotiated on project basis, and it'll be interesting to see where that landing spot eventually is sighted. Speaking of issues, I think you mentioned the new duty holder regime. I've heard some concerns being raised about the competencies around all of the various new duty holder regimes. I'm just wondering if you could just explain briefly that new duty holder regime and the competencies surrounding that. And I've heard some commentary about delays in achieving those competencies. And I'm just wondering if you could touch briefly on that.
Yes. So I think, as most people are aware, now the Act introduces new duty holder roles of the client, designer, contractor, principal designer and principal contractor, and those are modelled on the CDM regulations, but from a building safety perspective. And as you've mentioned, one of the areas where we're seeing most concern surrounds competency, as duty holders need to have the necessary skills, knowledge, experience and behaviours to carry out the particular work in question. However, the regulations don't go as far as to detail the level of competence required. So there is some people are querying, how do we demonstrate competence? And there is some information out there, is some guidance out there to help with this. So the British Standards Institution has publish a suite of publicly available specifications. And these set out, there's the BSI Flex 8670, and that sets out the core principles of competence. And there's also the PASS 8671 and the PASS 8672, which are specific to principal designers and principal contractors. And they set out the minimum competence requirements for those roles. So that's a good place to start, as it will enable duty holders to understand the thresholds and assess whether there are any gaps that need to be improved or worked on to meet those minimum thresholds. And it also enables clients to assess whether someone is competent by reference to those minimum thresholds. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't say how to demonstrate or evidence that competence. And this is where we're seeing a lot of concern. How can we demonstrate it? How can we evidence that we are competent? And from clients, they're concerned, how can we ensure that the people that are saying they're competent are actually competent? So there's a number of ways where this could be done. So, for example, demonstrating relevant experience and carrying out the type of work being undertaken. Attending professional and technical training with professional bodies. Undertaking regular CPD training to ensure their skills and knowledge remains up to date. Holding qualifications from recognised accredited institutions. And also participating in competency schemes or accreditation programs, which are specifically designed for assessing and validating competency in building safety management. But as you mentioned, Mike, a lot of the duty holders may not be quite up to that standard as yet, and this may potentially cause delays. So it's how do duty holders demonstrate competence, and how do they get there in a time-efficient manner, I think, is the key concerns here.
Thanks, Mel. And talking of sort of new duty holder regimes, Sylvia, I know from 1 October, when buildings are in occupation or to be occupied, there are new obligations imposed on or new terminologies of the accountable person and principal accountable person. Just wondering if you could just explain a little bit about those roles and obligations.
Yes, absolutely. From the 1st of October 2023, we now have a concept of an accountable person and a principal accountable person. So these are very new definitions. The accountable person is the person responsible for building safety risks when a building is occupied. And this could be an individual, it could be partnership, corporate body, who either holds a legal estate in possession in any part of the common parts, or is under a relevant repairing obligation for the property. So naturally, there might be several accountable persons for the building, but only one of them will be the principal accountable person.
See, and so you say that there's one building could have a number of accountable persons. Are you seeing sort of debates between those accountable persons as to which one is effectively the principal accountable person?
Yes, there is quite a lot of debate on this subject, particularly since the principal accountable person will be responsible for some key areas of building management. For example, as Mel mentioned, registration of the higher risk buildings, which was due on the 1st of October. As Melanie mentioned as well, sanctions for not fulfilling these obligations are quite significant. So in the run-up to the mentioned deadline, we saw an influx of instructions in this respect, and some of them resulted in applications to the first tier tribunal to determine who the principal accountable person for that particular building is likely to be.
Yeah, and I think sort of given the, as you say, and both yourself and Mel have said, you know, the role of a principal accountable person now carries very significant obligations and consequences for failure to comply with those obligations. So it's a pretty severe regime that was implemented in October of last year. So it's significant changes, I see it from your side in terms of the occupation of those buildings. The principal accountable person, or the PAP, they've been termed, as I understand it, they're also responsible for applying for the building safety case. Could you just talk to the listeners about building assessment certificates and what that is?
Yes, that's right. So the principal accountable person must, within 28 days from being asked by the building safety regulator, apply for what's called a building assessment certificate. And the intention of that building assessment certificate is to allow the regulator to assess whether the accountable persons are, at least at the time of the application being considered, complying with their duties under Part 4 of the Building Safety Act. So the Act does not say exactly when such requests should be made, but it is anticipated that the regulator will start calling for these applications from 6th April this year. So for the existing buildings, the regulator will request that application for a building assessment certificate are made over a 5-year period, with priority given to those buildings that are deemed to present the greatest risk.
5 years? Wow, that seems a pretty long time. How do you see that impacting on, I know, let's say, potential leasehold purchases of individual units, or indeed the freehold ownership of those buildings where you do have a PAP in place?
Yes, this is a long time, and the main concern is that until the building assessment certificate is in place, the property might be obviously less marketable for the prospective tenants. So the leaseholders wishing to sell the flats might find that there is less interest in the properties. Prospective buyers might find that lenders are not willing to grant a mortgage against the property without the building assessment certificate. And the freeholders might not be able to dispose of the freehold without such certificates. So the delay of 5 years could have a significant impact on everyone involved, although obviously much of that remains to be seen.
And so what about any other regulatory changes for occupied buildings?
Building Safety Act introduced a significant change in the way the costs for remediation works for defective buildings are recovered, and how service charges are going to be treated in respect of these works. So in the run-up to the implementation of the Act, there was a heated debate on whether the leaseholders should bear the cost of the works. And this effectively resulted in the Schedule 8 being inserted into the Act, which provides some protection against these costs for the qualifying leaseholders, but also in some cases, non-qualifying leaseholders.
Yes, and that is one of the underlying issues in the Triathlon case that I mentioned at the outset, and which we'll be discussing in our the next episode on the recoverability of remediation costs, and we'll cover that in some more detail. Mel, turning to new regs brought in on 6th of April, what for you have been some of the key changes there?
So from a construction perspective, I think the biggest change that's been brought in on 6th of April is the end of the transitional arrangements. So as I briefly mentioned earlier, there are 6 month transitional arrangements for the gateway regime for duty holders and also the registration of building control professionals. So all of those required an initial notice or floor plans to be deposited with the local authority before the 1st of October 2023 and not rejected. And then there are a few additional hurdles that needed to be jumped by the 6th of April 2024. So for the gateways, works must have been sufficiently progressed by the 6th of April. And the definition of sufficiently progressed is the pouring of concrete for the permanent placement of the trench, pad, raft or foundations, or the permanent placement of piling for new building work, or where work has started to an existing building. So the person who is responsible for the work must have given notice to either a local authority or the building control approver that the works have sufficiently progressed, and that notice must have been given within 5 days after the work was regarded as being sufficiently progressed, and in any event, no later than the 6th of April 2024. And if there is more than one building, one notice will be required per individual building. In addition, if we went down the approved inspector route, then the approved inspector must be registered as a building control approver by the 6th of April 2024. That has quite significant ramifications if you fail to do so, because the initial notice will cease to have effect and the building safety regulator will become the new building control authority and the works will essentially transfer to the new high-risk building regimes and gateways 2 and 3 would apply. For duty holders, to continue under the existing building control regime, works must have commenced by the 6th of April 2024. So starting work is a slightly different definition and it relates to any element of the permanent notifiable building work. And again, two notices will have need to have been submitted by the 6th of April 2024. So a notice must be submitted at least 2 days before the duty holders intend to start work on a non-higher risk building and 5 days for a higher risk building. And then a further notification must be submitted no more than 5 days after the work has commenced. And I also mentioned there was the registration of building control professionals. So 6th of April 2024 marked the deadline of registration for building control approvers and building inspectors. And from that date, you must be registered if you're working on any higher risk buildings and the building safety regulator will have an established register with defined registration criteria. In regards to the building inspectors, there has been concern in the industry that there's maybe not enough building inspectors that will be registered by this deadline.
Yeah.
And there are four classes. So there's class one, and that's where they can only work under supervision. And the registration process for that class doesn't require a competency assessment. And then there's classes two and three, which can work unsupervised, and class four, which is technical managers. Registration for classes two, three, and four require a competency assessment as part of the registration process. That's quite a rigorous progress and it's taken quite a lot of time. And what we've seen is actually we haven't got enough registered building inspectors. And so to address this, the Director of Building Safety recently announced that there would be a 13-week extension to the 6th of July 2024 for building inspectors to complete their competency assessment. But that's conditional on a number of points. So they would need to be an existing building control professional and already registered as a class one building inspector by 6th of April 2024. They must be enrolled in one of the building safety regulator approved competency assessment schemes by 6th of April 2024. And also a scheme provider must not have said that they've not passed their competency assessment for a second time.
It seems to me that there's, in some ways, industries and commentators thought that the 1st of October was bringing about significant change. Based on what you said there, Mel, even the 6th of April is even more significant change and has the potential for more disruption within the industry if those parties haven't been registered in time and there is potential scenarios where the registration process may have to start again for those buildings?
Absolutely. If they haven't been registered by that date, and then the higher risk regime will kick into force and it will be the benefit of the transitional provisions where the works would proceed under the previous building control regime and would essentially be lost. So you're going to be looking at those delays I talked about earlier, the additional competencies, all those additional hurdles that come with the higher risk building regime.
More paperwork, undoubtedly, to wade through, not only for us lawyers, but also for our clients and the construction professionals, undoubtedly. Sylvia, from your perspective, what have been the key changes from 6th of April?
So the significance of 6th of April for occupied high-risk buildings is that we anticipate the regulator to now call for the applications for the building assessment certificate, which, as I said earlier, must be provided within 28 days from that request. So this means that the preparation for this event, for this request, should already be well underway. In the first 12 months, these requests are going to be directed to specific buildings, but following that period of time, the regulator will be extending the scope to all qualifying buildings. So this, the significance of 6th of April is in relation to building assessment certificates, but the most changes really for occupied higher risk buildings actually came into force in January this year. And this was when the 6th commencement order was introduced in January, and it brought into force various sections of the Act which relate to the management responsibilities of the accountable persons. So for example, now the principal accountable person, we have to produce a safety case report, which, whilst we've known about it for some time, it now became a legal requirement. Such a report is meant to contain any assessments of the building safety risks, and brief description of any steps taken by the accountable person for the building to ensure that the building is safe for occupation and continues to be safe. So the principal accountable person will be responsible for providing a copy of the report, of the safety case report, to the regulator upon request, but also keeping this report updated and notifying the regulator about any variation. So that one change. The other change is an introduction of obligation to prepare the residence engagement strategy. This is a newly enacted section, which now requires the principal accountable persons to prepare a strategy for promoting the participation of relevant persons in the making of building safety decisions for the building. So this effectively means that the principal accountable persons will be responsible for having a clear strategy in place, which will allow them to liaise with the residents in respect of the management of the building and the performance of their duties. A copy of that strategy then has to be provided to every resident over the age of 16, but also to the owners of each individual residential unit in the building. And lastly, the 6th commencement order brought into force provisions related to complaints procedures. The principal accountable persons are now responsible for putting in place and operating a system for the investigation of these complaints related to building safety risks affecting the building and also performance of duties by the accountable person. So there's quite a lot to get to grips with. I mean, these aren't the only changes brought by the 6th commencement order, but they are significant ones for the clients and for the principal accountable person and accountable person to understand and put in place as soon as possible.
As with quite a lot of these obligations, there's incentives or sticks within the regulations for compliance. What are the potential sanctions if someone doesn't comply with these obligations?
Yes, again, the sanctions are significant. The 6th commencement order actually brought in force section 101 of the Act, which says that if the accountable persons have failed to comply with their duties and this failure created a risk of death or serious injury, then that failure will constitute a criminal offence and make the accountable person liable to imprisonment and fine. So certainly significant impact there on the principal accountable person and accountable persons as the whole.
Yeah. I mean, the whole regime is very much sort of, as I see it, sort of imposing these obligations and using the threat of criminal sanctions and fines to ensure compliance. And I know, speaking from many clients, they are alive to all of these issues and are following them up, and they are complying with all of their various deadlines because of those sanctions are so significant.
Absolutely.
You've gone through and mentioned that there are a number of key documents that need to be produced both by the regulator and the principal accountable person. Does the regulations impose any sort of requirement as to where they should be kept or whether they should be made available for other parties?
Yes, so the principal accountable person is required to keep all these documents in the golden thread, which we mentioned before. And once the safety case report is ready, the principal accountable person will then have to notify the regulator of it via the online portal. They don't have to share anything via the online portal at this stage with the regulator, unless they are asked for it. For example, when we talked about the building assessment certificate, that is the time to share these documents with the regulator. It is important, however, that the principal accountable persons have all the documents ready and stored electronically in a clear and easily to navigate way, so that when they are asked to provide these documents, they are easily accessible. As I've mentioned before, the timescales for providing relevant documents to the regulator are very short.
Thank you, Sylvia and Mel, for that trip through the past 6 months and the key regulatory changes that are being brought about and are already in force, and which parties which this applies to should be making sure that they are complying with all of their obligations because of those sanctions that you mentioned, Sylvia, that, you know, they are very severe. Thank you again to Sylvia and to Melanie for your time today. Very insightful, very helpful. And in our next episode, we will look at the impact of building liability orders and remediation contribution orders and the way in which they can impact on the ownership structures of buildings in the future.
This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.